Hello and welcome to Moments That Rock. For those tuning in for the first time, Moments That Rock is basically industry insiders and artists sharing moments that rock their world, as well as highlighting their career and bringing it up to date with what they're up to now. In the early episodes, we have some amazing back catalogues. Four programmes on U2 from various people involved with the band over the years. There's the Cramps, there's Ray Davis, Sir Ray Davis, should I say. There's the Ramones and Steve Winwood. And plenty more. And go check it out. And if you like this, go subscribe, tell your friends, and listen to the other stuff on the Pantheon group of podcasts, which is all, incidentally, music-only podcasts. Excellent place to be. I'm delighted to be there. Today, we have part two of the Ireland Book of Records, 1959 to 1968, volume one, in fact, edited by Mr. Neil Story, an old colleague of mine from Ireland Records. Last week was great, but we ran out of time. This week, we haven't. He's back. Neil Story. I'm looking through the preview thing that you sent me, which is lots of beautiful images and covers and backstage passes and things. And yet on page 16, I see the unforgettable Fire Grace Jones Steel Pulse, which doesn't fit into the chronological years you've got here.
Yeah, that's all part and parcel of the preface. Something that the MUP wanted me to write, which was basically why I've written the book, and to give a little bit of, make it personal, and a little bit of personal, if you like, history. So it ducks and dives from, you know, when I was living in New York back to when I was growing up in the village that Nick Drake grew up in. We lived 100 metres away from each other in Tamworth in Arden. And then, you know, there's bits of I don't know, Steel Pulse is there illustratively, from the Ku Klux Klan sleeve. Grace Jones is in there. That's, again, illustratively. But that early section is really just sort of, if you like, setting the reader up in a way to sort of draw them into what the book is all about, because it's also followed by a historical bit on the Blackwell family and how they came to move from the Spanish countries in the Middle Ages and land up essentially in Jamaica as a result of religious persecution. So, and then that develops into his mother and father marrying, and then him being schooled at Harrow. He wasn't expelled. His mother was told that, quote unquote, Christopher may be happier elsewhere. So it kind of ends with that, and then him going back to Jamaica. It's detailed, but it's not kind of detailed down the yin-yang, if you like. And then it goes into the first of the Jamaican albums.
It's funny, because while you were deep in writing all this up and researching, he actually released his only book, didn't he, Mr. Blackwell, after all these years?
He did indeed. And we spoke in, when was it? November last year. And he called. And I really, really wasn't expecting his call at all. But he'd seen a very kind of, not early, but an early-ish demo of what we were up to. There's never been any secrets about what we're up to. And he called completely out of the blue one evening. The line connection was pretty bad, so it was cold, but I had to take it outside. And so I'm standing there freezing my nuts off. And he, by this time, is back in New York, presumably in a nice, warm, heated apartment. And we got to the end of the conversation. And I said, look, you know, your book's all very well, but there are some things that I'd really like to talk to you about that really weren't covered in the book. Yeah, and then there was this long, long pause. And I thought, oh, bollocks. I've really stepped over it here. I've asked the unforgivable question. Do you mind if I, you know, because I said to him, look, I want to come and talk to you. Would you mind? Anyway, eventually he kind of came back. The line crackled again. And he said, yeah, okay, why not? So I got to spend some time with him in Jamaica in March. We had to push the deadline back for this volume because of that. But I got some incredible stories from him, and they're just kind of, it's just adding colour to some of the things that that I already had, and some of that will go into volume two as well.
You can call yourself a rock historian after this, I can safely say. But like myself, I mean, you were there before I was at Island, but for me, it was, I'd been buying all the records in the 60s, and now they were going to pay me, and I was going to get all the records for free. So I ended up working for my all-time favourite record label. So was this kind of a labour of love? Did you feel you had to do this? Because obviously you had a lot of knowledge, and you had great relationships. I presume, have you reached out to the Steve Winwoods of the world?
Steve was the first interview I did for this, believe it or not.
Really?
And it was. I can't look at it online or on the computer and tell you the exact date of the interview. I rang up James, who looks after Steve, and said, look, this is what I'm doing. Is Steve prepared to, you know, do an interview? And he said, I can, but ask. Anyway, so it was, okay, come down. We'll meet halfway. Steve selected a pub. We had lunch, and I basically taped our lunch. And we just talked about all manner of stuff, all manner of, you know, early traffic, obviously, right the way through till whenever it was. And he said to me at the end, he said, you've asked me questions that nobody's asked before. I was very flattered by that, actually. I have enough on tape from him that will last right the way through to the end of, you know, his time at Island. But yeah, I did. I reached out, as you call it, to all manner of people like that. Penny Masso was another one. Oddly, she springs into mind because I got an email from her today. She was Steve's girlfriend in the early days of Spencer Davis Group and Traffic. Some fascinating insights from her as well.
If you delve back into the early editions of Moments That Rock, you'll find Mr. Winwood in there, along with the Cramps and the Ramones and Ray Davis and everything. Because it's funny, because I worked Ark of a Diver, and I took Steve out on the road, and we got on really well. It was incredible, really, because when you're kind of working with somebody like that, I mean, I'm sitting there, I think we had a curry or something, and Branson signed him when he was floating the label, didn't he? Because he'd had a number one album in the States, and obviously he put a lot of kudos into getting funding for the airline. And he would only do one interview, and it was with me, for it was MTV for Europe. Right. And they had a camera over me. But I went down to do an interview for my own show. And you know what record companies are like, Neil. It was at the Halcyon, where a lot of people said, nice hotel in Kensington, wasn't it? All the Virgin glitterati were there, you know, the kind of managing directors, the head director of promotion, sales, blah, 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 all the fancy, you know, catering up there and everything. All got to sign a number one artist, you know. And if you remember, the album, first album on Virgin was Roll With It. And I interviewed John Webster, and that album sleeve cost like 75 grand. John told me, because I had John on this a while back, you know, Moments That Rock. And then, he had this fancy shirt, obviously appealing to a female audience, a slinky kind of silk or satin white shirt or something. So I get met in the Halcyon Hotel, and a girl brings me up to do the interview. And it was funny because I got a list of questions sent from Virgin Italy, Virgin France, Virgin Sweden, whatever, you know. And I'm reading on the train going down. And it's like, you got to remember, this is a guy who's got his new album coming out, right, on a new label, very important, priority, as they call it. And the questions were, what is your favourite Traffic song? Were the swinging 60s really as swinging as they were made out to be? And I'm thinking, you poor sod, you've got to answer these dumbass questions. So I had a three-hour train journey, so I'm writing things down. So the two things that I'll never forget, this, the two things that I remember were, I get taken up into the room, she opens the door, and there's all the catering table with all the fancy sandwiches and the cakes and the coffee and glass of wine and all this, and all the glitterati, and Steve's in a table in the corner just waiting for me, you know. And I open the door, and he's got the white shirt on. So I look across and go, have you not got another fucking shirt? That's the... So all this Virgin mob, Neil, they're like this. They're looking at me like, you know, of course he laughs. you know. And then I sit down to interview him. My first question was, and dead serious face, Steve, as an artist, bearing in mind the questions I just read, as an artist, would you rather be played at 33 and a third or 45? My next question was, how magic were your mushrooms? And he's just pissing himself laughing, and they're all like, you know. So anyway, if you remember around that time, he did a series of, which you probably went to, a series of concerts at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah.
And Clapton played on, I don't know if he's there every night. But what, am I correct in thinking, wasn't that the time that he'd married an American lady and she was managing him?
Yeah, it was around about that time. He was newly married to Genia at that point, I believe. There was quite a period of time when we didn't see him. And then, yeah, around that kind of the Virgin era was a time when I didn't see very much of him. But, you know, he was always, I don't know, for some reason or other, you either got on with him or you didn't get on with him. There were no half measures with Winwood as far as I was concerned. And you did or you didn't. And I think you did, and I know I did. Maybe it was because we were relaxed around,
yeah, you know, without doubt,
kind of stature. There was no kind of, I don't know, treading on whatever eggshells or anything like that. There was no kind of, I don't know, blowing smoke up his arse or anything like that. It was just, you know, it was real people. That's the only way I can really describe it. And so it was really nice that he did what he did for me. And, you know, we've seen each other since, obviously, albeit I'm not back in the UK very often. And, you know, I do quite a lot of work for Universal. So I was very involved in the Atmos remix of the Low Spark album, which was last year. I did all the tape research for that. So we were speaking quite a lot on the phone. And, you know, it's always total courtesy. And, you know, it's just amazing. I like him a lot.
You listen to Moments That Rock, part of the Pantheon Media Group of podcasts, with Neil Storey, who was on last week's podcast. This is part two about the Island Book of Records, Volume 1. Great listens to stories about Steve Winwood, I must confess. One of my favourite artists to work with. Great guy, brilliant musician. And those were the days, as they say. But I won't get too nostalgic.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Am I busting into tears? We're on that, do we? Back after this. In our heyday, when we were, you know, PR, so to speak, I always found the biggest artists were the easiest to work with because they realise it's not all about them. It's about a team of people around them. And they're never late. They never arrive screwed up, you know, or anything like that. And they never complain or look bored in interviews and stuff. So my experience of, you know...
I'm not sure that I would agree with that. I think...
Well, I suppose I was lucky then.
No, I think the... Well, personally speaking, the easiest ones I worked with were the ones with whom... There were no pretenses. He was just straightforward with whoever it was, and it didn't really matter whether it was the Buggles or the Distractions or Basement Five or whoever it was. It didn't really matter. It was all about just being straightforward.
Because I have some hilarious stories which I've shared. Was like I ran out of gas on the motorway with Peter Gabriel, you know, taking to an interview. I mean, who goes out on a promo tour without checking their fuel? Me. And the other thing was I had Sting do, I had the police around Every Breath You Take, and I had him doing like Cheggers Plays Pop, which was, of course, a national TV show on the BBC. And he was filming June at the time, and he only had a limited amount of time to come to get a shuttle from London up to Manchester. So I'm shooting down, you know, the dual carriageway to pick him up, you know, flying at the multi-story car park up, slam the door, down the escalator, walk into the concourse, and there's the arrivals. And it comes up and it's arrived. I'm going, yeah, perfect timing, man, you know. So I walk up like this, dead proud of myself. He comes off, he's got his arm in a sling, you know. So we walk down, how are you doing? So blah, 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 we have a little gab, you know. Get into the elevator, he's standing by the buttons. He goes, where you parked? I go, I have no idea where I left my car. So I'm on level 8, shouting down, is it there? He says, not here, Tony. So I said, well, you go up one and I'll go down one. Now, you got to remember, this was like Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. Every Breath You Take, shall I say. They were the biggest band in the world. Could you imagine coming back from a meeting in London and seeing Sting with his arm in a sling walking around Manchester Airport car park looking for a car? So I'm proud of the chaos that I kind of got away with, so to speak. But seriously, Neil, going back, I mean, obviously, like, this is fantastic, and I'm not read it all, but I certainly intend to and stuff. But, you know, there's a whole romantic side to it. You must have, like, it was a labour of love, really, wasn't it? I mean, you kind of delving into, like, your youth, in a way, and your career, and you're delivering something. But you were just learning more and more. I find that, and this is totally self-indulgent in a way, because my premise with doing Moments That Rock is if I enjoy the stories, why wouldn't other people? When I interviewed Tim Clark, who was the MD in 78 when I started, I'm getting like the history of Island Records, you know, from the 60s when he started. And I'm sitting there with my mouth open thinking, this is amazing. This is like a history lesson for me.
You said something very interesting earlier. And you said
just
it was
the one
all
thing.
About, sorry?
Just the one thing.
Yeah, half a thing. What I was going on to say was that you did allude to this, and I'll kind of take the alluding a little bit further, which is that I think you and I were very lucky because we got paid to actually indulge our hobby.
Exactly, yeah.
By that I mean that, you know, we're both voracious collectors of music, certainly at that time, voracious devourers of music. And suddenly somebody comes along and says, actually, I'll pay you to do this. How fucking good does it get?
I think the important thing you mentioned was the graciousness, the fact that, you know, you're probably the same, but I don't think it's until, you know, like we live in a different time now. We were at a halcyon period of music. But when you come down the line, I'm always saying to people that I don't think I fully appreciated it until the roller coaster stopped. Because you're so full on. You're probably on $5 an hour, the amount of hours you put in.
You'd wake up and you would not know what the end of the day held for you. You did not know what was going to happen that day. So every day, in essence, became an enormous adventure. You were treading into the unknown the entire time because there were no rules. You made it up. You did this just as much as we did. You made it up as you went along.
You said something about 30 years ago that I still use to this day. We came from a generation, made it up when we were as we went along. And it's so true. It's so true. It's not how to do industry. There's no two labels alike, two managers, no two bands. So, you know, you have to learn your trade on the street because it's, I did an interview for my book last year, several. And one of the first ones I did, this guy, there's a piece in my book about meeting Led Zeppelin when I was 15, you know, managed to get them backstage and hanging around there. And you get to realize what it's like to meet your heroes. And he said to me, What do you feel the music industry taught you, Tony, that would have helped you meeting Led Zeppelin as a 15-year-old? I said, well, you know, not as much as you think. They said, really? I said, yeah. I said, you know, when I was 6 or 7, I realised I didn't want to hang out on the school playground with this jerk who was a bully. And when I'm in my teens discovering girls, you had to kind of stand in front of them and ask them out and fear rejection. Well, you think, I was 15. I had no idea I was going to work in an industry where communication skills were vital. And then all of a sudden, I learned my communication skill. That quote of yours came back to literally haunt me because I thought, I learned my communication skills out on the street. You don't learn to drive a car until you pass your test. You don't learn interpersonal skills and stuff at school. In our day, they teach us Latin and stuff.
I don't even know what interpersonal skills are. We were lucky we grew up in a world where there wasn't any of this corporate buzz speak stuff. And you had to learn. You were given the job and you either got on with it and did it or you screwed up. It was literally black or white. There were no grey areas at all.
But there were also people that were employed purely for the fact that they loved music. It's not like we had qualifications for the job. And if you think of it, in our time, Neil, you started a bit before me. But the thing is, like from the 70s and stuff, you mentioned Chris Blackwell. We learned from the best. We're talking Chris Blackwell, Ahmed Oettinger, Jerry Moss, Herb Alpert. These were all music people. They weren't accountants and lawyers running labels.
Oh, sure.
And Chris Blackwell was putting records out that he would have had in his own collection.
Right. But, you know, the other great thing about CB was that he gave the artists he signed time to develop. And I think that's a really, really
exactly
facet. So if you look at, just as an example, you look at Robert Palmer, it took 5 albums for him to achieve mainstream success either side of the Atlantic. He'd have been dropped in this day and age because he didn't have the success straight out of the bag. We all know what happened when a certain MD decided that they should be dropped after the release of the October album. He lost his job. So many instances of that people were signed. And, you know, the first Cat Stevens album didn't exactly set the world alight. Lady Durbanville was a hit. Ish, but nothing much more than that. It was only Teaser and Tillerman where it went stratospheric.
But you remember in those days, because you were, especially with working in press and things, you were in the area of artist development. That was always the favourite part of my job. And the thing is, correct me if I'm wrong, I think I heard this from Rob, but you two were into Ireland for like $250,000 in tour support. And they couldn't afford to pay them. So you two were prepared to wait for the money. I don't think if you two had signed to an EMI or a CBS, as it was at the time, that they would be where they are today, because they would have been dropped. If you remember when we were there, they dropped Ultravox and not you two, didn't they?
It wasn't at the same time, but it was...
No, but it was late 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Ultravox, a lot of money was poured into them. And it just didn't come good. It's the same with Mott the Hoople. They just didn't come good. They weren't selling the records. The Jess Roden Band, another one, they just weren't selling the records to justify the expense that was being put into them.
Just going back to your Island Book of Records, I presume it's a limited edition, eh?
First printing. It's in the thousands.
And how much does it cost?
How much does it cost? In the UK, it's 85 quid, but it's being... £85, it's being heavily discounted in all sorts of places, from individual shops to Amazon to MUP themselves. So truthfully, it has a set price, but it isn't being sold at that set price. What it is in America, genuinely, I don't know, but it's over $100, I know that much. You know what I would have loved to have done? I would have loved to have put a compilation together, you know, maybe 2, maybe 3 CDs, maybe even 4 CDs to go at the back of this book. I would have loved to have done that. It would have been, unhappily, an absolute nightmare for the clearing of the tracks and all of that kind of stuff. And also, you know, finding some of that really obscure stuff that they don't necessarily have. It's a pity that hasn't happened, because I think then it really could have been seen as, you know, even more definitive than perhaps it is being touted as at the moment. But you can't have everything, can you?
Can you think of any one person you would have loved to have got to that you didn't get to interview for this?
There was a lady called Elsa Peters. Elsa and I were communicating, and she was Chris's, virtually his first assistant at 155 Oxford Street, and then it didn't happen. So it would have been nice to get a little memory or two from her. A few people who died, pre-deceased, if you like, I would have loved to have spoken to, but, you know, you can't turn the hands of time back, can you?
Marley would have been a gem, wouldn't he, Bob?
Well, yes and no, but, you know, Bob's story is so well known.
Yeah,
it's actually trying to find the bits around those stories. So in terms of when we get to do Catch a Fire, it won't be Bob necessarily, Peter or Bunny. It will actually be the original sleeve designers. You know, because I don't believe that the guys who actually, it's Bob somebody or other, who put the Zippo sleeve together, I don't believe he's ever talked about that. To me, those are the interesting bits.
Find back in the day that the artwork for the sleeves, those were the things when I was like in my teens, you know, getting into music. Those are the records that made you pull them out of the racks at HMV and Virgin and get curious about what the music is like and go into the booth to listen to them. The artwork was so important.
Chris said something very important. He said that if the sleeve is really good, then it might mean that the music inside is equally as good. So therefore, to put a record in a sleeve that people, as you just said, they'll thumb through the record racks and go, "Oh, hold on, that's kind of interesting." Then that has achieved that point. He also, I remember talking to him about this, and he said, actually, there were at least one act I sent back because the sleeve was better than the record.
Great. Love it. Well, this is an amazing piece of work, Mr. Story. And what can I say but, you know, congratulations and things. Are you really pleased with it yourself?
When we got the finished copies, the first finished copies through, I do remember standing there and I did start stroking it.
Yeah, good man.
I don't know whether that's actually a good thing, a bad thing, or whether it's me being a bit, I don't know. But am I proud of it? Yeah, I have to tell you, I really, really am. And the one thing I'm looking forward to more than anything is actually handing CB his own copy.
Yeah. You should get a signed copy off him for your own. I bet he's never signed anything in his life.
But you know the other thing that's in there that I think has really taken people a bit by surprise, and that is the I was contacted, this was a few months ago, now quite a few months ago, but do you remember a lady called Christine Atkins? And she was the last surviving person of, if you like, Old Ireland, when Ireland was sold, and then she then went on to work for Universal. Anyway, I got this email from her completely out of the blue. She's married now. She's by name Christine Goff and lives in Northern Ireland. And she said, "I've got something which I think might be of use to you for the books." So I said, "Oh, really? What's that?" And she said, "It's the very first director's book. It charts the first board meetings." I said, "Well, how on earth have you got something like this?" And she said, "I rescued it from the back of a skip. When they were moving offices, and there was always a skip at the back of Ireland at St. Peter's Square. So there would be, you know, phones that didn't work. There would be bundles and bundles of posters or singles that hadn't sold or albums that hadn't sold or whatever it was. Anyway, I used to dive into that skip from time to time, and I've rescued photographs. I've got some extraordinary stuff. Mainly it was photographs I was after. Anyway, and nobody had any use for them. Fine, they'll go in the back of a cupboard and maybe they'll be useful for me at some point. And boy, have they become so. Anyway, so she did exactly the same thing. And she saw this big brown envelope, thought, "I wonder what's inside that." Opened it up, and it was the original director's book. So anyway, I've scanned two or three pages from it, and that's part of the, if you like, the developing story of Ireland. That stuff should be in a bloody museum.
You have been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides. We'll be back next week. Today's show was part two of Neil's story, talking about volume one of the Ireland Book of Records, 1959 to 1968. An absolute masterpiece. So thank you, Neil, for that, and we will see you next week. Hope you like it. Go tell your friends, subscribe, and come back for more.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.